So, thank you. It's good to be back a year later. I'm not sure I like that list of numerical assessments in my life. It's kind of daunting. That's really a euphemistic way of saying, boy, are you getting old? Okay, let's jump into this. This is a rough translation into modern English of what Galileo wrote. To understand the universe, you have to understand the language in which it is written, and that language is mathematics. Galileo, of course, was the first. A bunch of people around that time, Galileo being perhaps the most significant, invented modern science, the scientific way of looking at the world, where to understand the world, you attach numbers to it, and then you understand it by way of looking at relationships between those numbers. The numbers are all fictions. I mean, there is no such thing in the world as temperature. It's an invention we have that reflects the state of the world. And we have inventions like mass, distance, speed, velocity, yada, yada, yada. And we look at pressure. And amongst those things that we invent to attach to the world, we can then look at the relationship between them, forces, mass times acceleration, which arguably is a definition of one of them. But we can put all of these things together, and that gives us understanding. Not only does it give us understanding, but we can use that understanding to develop our sciences, our technologies. Well, the understanding really is our sciences. Develop our technologies, our medicines, our communications devices, and so on and so on. So the world has changed dramatically with increasing speed since the 17th century when Galileo put forward this way of looking at the world. And what I'm going to do tonight is give some examples, ones that I always found curious. And over the course of my career, at various times I found moments to look these things up. From a pedagogical point of view, they're all examples that at one time or another I've used when I've gone into high schools or colleges or universities to give guest lectures to students. The kind of things that you can begin with and pique people's interest. In most cases, the mathematics is actually, at the very least, upper level undergraduate math major or graduate level. So the actual mathematics behind what I'm going to talk about is pretty advanced stuff. That's not the point. The point is to know that the mathematics... I will actually show you some of the equations, if only to show you that, boy, simple questions can sometimes have very difficult answers and complicated answers. But we're going to begin with the one that's in the title, Why Don't Golf Balls Have Dimples? Or another way of putting it is, how does a golf ball fly? Well, first question is, does it fly or does it simply move through the air because it's been hit by a club? The answer is it actually is flying, and the dimples are all to do with the fact that it's flying. Okay. And the way to understand it is to go to something called Bernoulli's equation, which goes back to an 18th century Swiss mathematician called Daniel Bernoulli, who's a member of a family, many of whose members were mathematicians, or at least four or five, I think maybe five or six Bernoullis that made, in many cases, in most cases, actually significant contributions to mathematics. It's often been said that calculus was invented by three people, Newton, Leibniz, and several Bernoullis. Bernoullis took it to quite another level. Okay, calculus, of course, invented in the 17th century. The Bernoullis came along. And calculus, when it was first invented, Newton was, of course, looking at the motion of the planets. It was discrete motion, orbits of planets and so forth. That was how it developed. Leibniz developed this geometric way of doing it. But it was essentially applying it to sort of continuous motion in a discrete world. Things like point masses or planets moving around. What Daniel Bernoulli did was take that approach and apply it to the motion of fluids, liquids, gases, air and so forth. And the mathematics, it develops a quite different flavour. Okay. Bernoulli's equation itself tells you that when you have a surface, like a golf ball surface, if you've got fluid, which could be air, it could be water, flowing over it, the pressure the fluid exerts on the surface decreases as the speed of flow increases. The equation you get, it's hard to read from the back, I'll tell you, it's velocity squared over 2 plus omega plus p over rho equals c. The key factors are v squared, velocity squared, p is pressure, and c is a constant. So if v goes up, p must go down. Okay? So you've got this relationship. One goes up, the other one goes down. Velocity goes up, pressure goes down. Ponds, yeah. Okay. Golf balls. Okay, we'll come back to Bernoulli's equation in just a half a second. The key is backspin. That's what's making these things go the distance they go. If you have a golf ball going left to right, and there's backspin, that means the airflow, since I don't want this ball to keep moving before us, I'm going to leave the golf ball fixed and imagine the air moving past it. It's the easier way to think about it. It's changing the frame of reference. So the air is flowing from right to left, and this thing is spinning. Okay, so that's the picture you need to have in mind. The backspin is going to drag the air with it. It's going to sort of pull it towards it. And down here, it's spinning that way, so it's pushing against the airflow. So here you've got airspeed plus extra speed that you've flipped it around, and here you've got airspeed minus the fact that you're pushing against it. So you've got faster moving air at the top than at the bottom. So Bernoulli's equation, the pressure on the top is less than the pressure on the bottom. So you've got an upward force, what we call lift. So it's the backspin that's making this thing work. So in fact, if you look at it, it's not that it isn't following a parabola. This is not the familiar parabola. This thing is rising. It's flying. Quite dramatically flying. How much backspin have we got? Well, if you're one of these guys, something like 3,000 revs a minute at 160 miles an hour. So not only have you got a lot of speed, but you've got a lot of backspin. And that's going to give you a lot of additional velocity, and then you can have velocity squared, and the pressure's got to change to account for that velocity squared. Dimples. They were actually introduced around the 1920s. What happened was, until then, golf balls were smooth, as smooth as they could make them. But golfers noticed that when a ball got older and had some nicks in it and was beginning to look a bit rough, it seemed to be going further. So they thought, aha, something about the roughness is making it go further. Then they started making it, played around with it, started making golf balls. The numbers vary, but the sort of the standard in the US is about 336, and the British one, I mentioned British because golf began in Scotland, so. The nice thing about having two passports is I can make derogatory comments about two countries. And over the recent years, I've found that very useful. Okay, so you can. So these were introduced to make systematic this increased lift that you're getting from the spinning. And the dimples actually serve two purposes. One, as we'll see, is they do increase the Bernoulli effect. You get a greater upward pressure, a greater upward force when you have those dimples. And the other one is there's an air friction. There's a drag. Friction's not the word to use. It's drag. I'll explain what it is. It's in a minute with a diagram. But you've got something that's trying to slow it down. It's partly friction, but there's a little bit more to it. And the dimples also reduce that. So there's a couple of things going on here. To the degree which a ball that's dimpled can go up to 2.5 times as far as one without dimples. And I know there are golfers in the room, so you might want to see if somehow you can get hold of a smooth golf ball and test this out. I'm not a golfer, so I was unable to perform empirical tests myself. And I'm taking this on faith from a number of sources, but I'm never quite sure whether these things have been exaggerated. But that's the best figure I could come up with. It was about 2.5 times further. Okay, so let's go back to the picture and see what's happening then. So you've got the air flowing in this direction, you've got the counterclockwise spin. Once again, the dimples are going to sort of make it sticky for the rough thing. I'm happy to use metaphors of a little bit loose here. The dimples are going to sort of make it, the air sort of stick to it a bit more, and they're going to drag that air with it. And here they're going to try to push the air back. So you actually do have an increase in air speed over the ball here. And at the bottom you have a decrease in air speed. So you do actually have an increased lift. The reason I'm saying this twice is it's very subtle. Einstein got it wrong. Okay. Not in the case of golf, because this was before golf balls and dimples, but Einstein tried to understand backspin and so forth. And you can tell the same story and actually get it the wrong way around. But the issue is you've got addition here of the airspeed. and you've got decrease there, so that's where you get the increase in speed, that's where you get the pressure going down. Okay? So the dimples are doing one thing, the dimples are increasing the tendency of the air to get dragged with the backspin, and they're decreasing the tendency of the air to get, because the spin is huge, 3,000 revs a minute, that's going to dominate the speed of the ball, so you've got a massive amount of speed, so you're going to get quite a dragging effect to reduce it there. So that's one of the things, is the reduction in, is the differential in speed between the top and the bottom, giving you the Bernoulli effect. But something else is going on, and this is a major factor as well, it's the drag issue. Air friction, the fact that you've got this object moving through the air, and the air doesn't want it to move, I mean the air was doing very well, thank you very much, until this ball comes through. And it doesn't want to move, and so it tries not to. But one of the things it has to do, it has to pat. I mean the ball's coming through the air molecules, and there's a couple of molecules that are getting along very friendly, they get pushed apart, and they push around it. So you've got molecules going in different directions, top and bottom, back along the sides, and at the back, you're going to have a sort of a tendency towards a vacuum. You've got this thing moving left to right behind the ball. You've got this area of lower pressure. So you've got another pressure differential between the front, where the ball is ramming into the air, and the back, where there's this sort of tendency towards a vacuum, if you like. So you've got a differential between the front and the back, which is slowing the ball down. Now that's going to happen with or without dimples. You're going to get the ball slowed down by drag. However, if you have dimples, what happens is the flow patterns change from what's known as laminar flow, which is really nice and smooth, moves over, separates, there it goes, and then you've got this area of lower pressure. Because the air has been sort of pushed out that way, and so you've got a pressure differential front to back, and it's slowing the ball down. Over here, and the thing is spinning all the time, but when you've got the dimples, it drags the air in such a way that you get what's known as turbulent flow. There's little vortices being formed. These are meant to be diagrams of little vortices. And that pushes the thing back together. So you've got a much smaller area here of turbulent area. And so you end up with a less great pressure differential. So you've got less drag. Okay. Another image. sort of doctored image from a wind tunnel. This is where you've got counterclockwise spin, you've got smoke being blown in, and you can actually see the vortices forming at the bottom end. So there's the other part of it, is the pressure differential that you get, or the reduction in the pressure differential from front to back, because the dimples create turbulence. Okay. You can experiment, and people have been experimenting with different kinds of dimples to see if you can increase the turbulence effect, or you can increase the Bernoulli effect. This is a ball which apparently you can buy from some sources, where you've got hexagonal dimples. I don't know how many there are on that one, but there's been all sorts of people playing around. Every now and then you'll see an article in the New York Times or somewhere, usually a little article somewhere, but a cute article about someone playing around with a different golf ball. I think there's been golf balls with almost into the thousands of dimples of different things. So there's been a lot of people playing around with this. I don't know whether there's regulation, PGA regulations that regulate this or not, I suspect there are. But there probably is scope for increasing the flights of balls considerably if the authorities, development authorities allow you to do it. Okay, so that was the Bernoulli's law. It's a fairly standard application of Bernoulli's law. And you can apply Bernoulli's law in a number of other situations. And one area where you often see it applied is to explain where airplanes fly. And I have to admit that if you go and look at some of the books I wrote many years ago, the popular books on mathematics, you will see an explanation of why airplanes fly in terms of Bernoulli's law. And it's wrong. If you go and look in many other books on mathematics of flight, you will find an explanation, you will find the same explanation, and it's wrong. Rather more worrying, if you go and look at manuals, instruction manuals for people learning how to fly planes, you will find the same wrong explanation. Now, it turns out that even if you don't understand the science, you can still fly a plane pretty safely, which is fine because I have to fly back to California in a couple of days' time. But the explanation is wrong. It doesn't take that long to figure out why it's wrong. Here's the explanation you find, and you'll see this image in books, you'll see variations of this image in books I've written, you'll see it on websites. And it says the wing has a nice air, what we call an aerofoil shape, and the air's coming in, the aircraft's going from left to right. So there's the airflow. And the story says, okay, the air's coming in, it gets forced to pass, some air has to go over, some goes under. The air at the top has further to go. So it has to go faster. So you've got greater speed here, lower pressure up here, higher pressure here, and you've got lift. Doesn't that sound convincing?
Yes.
Well, no. That depends upon the fact that two molecules here are so deeply in love, when it's all the way around, they want to come back together again. Who said they have to come back together again? They may start off together, they don't have to go faster, they could just go slower and go further, or they could go the same speed and then they'll just be out of sync. All sorts of things could happen, but there's no reason to assume, as this explanation does, that two molecules that are adjacent, the ones on the top will go faster because they want to cover a greater distance to meet up again at the other end. It just doesn't necessarily work that way. In practice, it doesn't work that way. Now, that's a sort of a scientific understanding, or it's looking for the hidden assumption, which is always a danger in science. There's a tacit assumption that needs to be justified, and in this case, cannot. What it says in here, by the way, this was just taken from a website, airflow is slower underneath the wing, therefore the air pressure is greater, slash higher. However, you have probably all seen the following. An airplane flying upside down. Wait a minute. If there's a net force due to the aerofoil, this thing should be dropping out of the sky big time, but it's flying and there's someone in another airplane taking a photograph. Airplanes can fly upside down. I'm told that even a 747 can fly upside down, which is a sight I do not want to see. And I believe it, because the mathematics actually sounds kind of plausible. So that alone, let alone the explanation of what the molecules tell you. So ignore that part of all of my earlier books, and ignore that part of everything else. If you want to see the real answer, this is. I'm not going to get into any of the details, I'm going to show you some pointers. If you really want to see the answer, go to the guys who do know a lot about flight, NASA, and go to the Glenn Research Center's website, and you'll find a nice explanation of the correct science. Here's the good news. This is their K-12 website. I like that. There's a chance I'm going to understand it. Okay. And there's all sorts of diagrams and explanations. The mathematics actually gets very deep very quickly. I'll give a little bit more, it's fairly complicated. If you really want to understand what keeps airplanes in the sky, forget Bernoulli's equation and all this complicated calculus stuff. Good old Newton will explain it. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Aircraft basically are designed so that they force the air downwards. If the air is forced downwards, something's got to go up, and it's the airplane. That's the wrong picture. It's more like this. Air is being forced downwards, not just over the wing, but the entire fuselage. The wing gives you some lift, but it's also to keep the thing stable. Now, you want to keep this thing right in. The fuselage itself is it. The air is being pushed down. Notice, and if you look carefully, this is the case. See movies or look at the sky. An airplane that's cruising points up slightly. There's a slight incline. If you're on an airplane and you put a marble on the floor, it will roll slowly backwards. So will a freshly polished iPhone. If your iPhone hits the floor, it will slowly slide backwards to the person behind it away it goes. At takeoff, it's even worse, because at lower speed, the plane needs to come up more. Why is it coming up more? Because it needs to force the air down at a greater angle, because it's going slower, and it needs to push it up. It's the upper, and if you look back at that other picture, it's actually pointing upwards. There's your lift. Nothing to do with the wings, it's because it's pointing up that way. Okay, let's move forward about. Okay. It's what's known as the attack angle. When an aircraft is, and this could be the wing or it could be the whole fuselage, when an aircraft is cruising, it has a small inclination, a low attack angle, the air has been forced slightly downwards, Newton's law gives you the lift. When you're taking off, you're at lower speed, so you angle it more, and the flaps and various things that assist this, you extend the flaps, you've got a greater area, then that compensates for the lower speed and you get the lift. If you go too steeply, then you enter the area of turbulence, everything breaks apart and you get these disasters. Okay, so that's what's actually going on. You don't need calculus to sort of understand it in simple terms. Newton's law of motion does it, action and reaction. There's a but. The image, the description I gave is essentially a two-dimensional cross-section explanation. It's as if it's all explained in terms of the cross-section, and it isn't. It turns out that lift is fundamentally three-dimensional. It's a very much more complicated thing than that. The Glenn Research Centre site doesn't go into this, but other sites and sources will, but you'll start looking at stuff like that. It's all sorts of complicated things going on. And it's a very, very interesting domain. The equations are almost never solvable except using numerical methods. So it's not just classical calculus. There's a lot of computational mathematics involved. It's a complicated domain, an interesting one. And the proof that it works is that these planes do take off and stay up there. At which point... this is the land of innovation, right? Wow, golf balls fly further. We're all worried about fuel efficiency. Why don't we put dimmers on airplanes to increase 2.5 times, et cetera, et cetera? The answer is, they still do. Where might you find an airplane where you would want to have some extra aerodynamic capabilities? The military. Are we going to find out the details? No. So you will not find, I don't think, an image of this guy. But there are some drawings floating around, at least there were when I took this one off the web. Now, I'm awfully close to the CIA headquarters here, so if I'm not around tomorrow for the workshop, guys, I shouldn't really have taken this. But there is this thing, they have these little strips that produce dimples, especially to produce the maneuverability of a fighter jet, where you want to have a lot of, which are built to be unstable. I mean, they want to be rapidly maneuverable. So whereas a 747 is built to be highly stable, almost impossible to crash, these are built to be so unstable that they need fast computers to keep them in the air, and the slightest thing goes wrong and they tend to drop out of the sky. But they do have some dimples. And in fact, you may have been on a little passenger commuter jet and looked out of the window and seen a wing with these things on it. I've seen that and I thought, have they finished building a wing? Or what bits are missing? Should there be flags on here or what? And I remember seeing that on occasion on small little planes and thinking, that's kind of weird. Those are what's known as vortex generators. That's an aeronautical equivalent of dimples. And the idea is that the air hits those and it creates the turbulence that you want to give you the same extra lift effect by breaking up the laminar flow. So in fact, you do have examples of dimples on aircraft, it's just that they're not actual dimples. And in fact, since the Tour de France begins on Sunday, I thought I'd be extremely topical and point out that I saw this in a cycling magazine about a year ago. This was an advert for a wheel beyond my pocketbook I might have, 2,285. And this caught my eye. The big change with the 404s is that they're dimpled like golf balls. Now it is the case that modern professional cycling, which is a big, expensive, high money sport, they do a lot of wind tunnel work, they employ aeronautical engineers, there's as much effort put into this these days as aeronautical design, and if you look at a close-up of that wheel, indeed it's all dimpled. So if you have $2,500, we need two wheels, right, so it's twice that amount of money, you can actually get that kind of effect on a wheel. In fact, if you're really a professional cyclist, and you're into time trialing, and you can afford $3,295, you can get an entire time trial wheel where the whole thing is dimpled. Now bear in mind that a professional cyclist on one of these things, that wheel is going around over 500 revolutions a minute. Okay, the cyclist is cycling about 100 revs a minute, he's got a 5-to-1 gear ratio, that thing is moving around. So that almost certainly will give you, well, it's not 3,000 revs of a golf ball, 500 a minute is a lot. So I'm quite prepared when I saw that to believe that probably is worth the money.
But that's a left-right thing as opposed to an up-down.
No, that's the way, that's going around that way, and those are the dimples. So you're going to create the flow over there is going to be turbulent, so you're not going to get it back. Well, it's not exactly the same phenomenon in the sense of the front and the back. Yes. Yeah. But the issue is to get the air off the, from dragging the thing. So get the air away from it so it's not just a friction. Otherwise you'd have basically an air friction break. And that's trying to stop the air friction break. Yeah, the dimples are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to break up the flow of the attachment. And I'll look at a couple more examples. Yeah, the actual mechanics is a little bit different. In fact, even the hubs of those things, this is the hub of a wheel, and that's where the spokes go in, and these guys even make a dimples hub. Whether that makes a difference, I don't know. Technology is one thing, but cycling is one of these sports where ultimately it comes down in large part to an individual. And this guy, who doesn't have many dimples, although he does have a lot of wrinkles these days, he still seems to be doing pretty good at 37 years of age. So the machine certainly does make some difference, but it doesn't necessarily make all the difference. But if you're really obsessive, and I saw someone actually came in with a cycle helmet on, so if you want to get on quicker, to have a dimpled helmet. Now, of course, that may just be a marketing gimmick. Well, then again, maybe you. While on the subject of Lance Armstrong, you keep reading these articles about how can anyone have won to that degree 7 times, winning the Tour of France after cancer. It was superhuman, it must be on drugs and so forth. May or may not be, I suspect not, given the amount the guy was testing, but there are other much easier explanations. Not least because what he did was not really superhuman. Basically, he won 2 stages out of a 3-week race. He won a time trial and 1 mountaintop finish, and that was enough to give you most years 5 to 7 minutes. And when you think about it, winning by a small number of minutes in a race that takes 3 weeks is kind of a small percentage. What he did and what his team did was just play those small percentages and do it very well. And we'll look at the science that went behind it.
The talent pool from which Lance draws is many layers deep. It represents some of the sharpest minds in technology, sports physiology, statistical analysis, and aerodynamics. The experts interact with each other like a Formula One development team, hence their name, the F1 Group. Much of the technology the F1 Group brings to racing is first tested in a wind tunnel, an environment originally designed to test aircraft components. Virtually everything is tested in the wind tunnel, from body position to the shirt on Lance's back.
When we looked at apparel as a piece of equipment, one of the interesting things in studying in the wind tunnel, we found that 2/3 of the drag comes off the body, whereas only 1/3 comes off of the bike itself. We recognize a huge opportunity to help the athlete's body be as efficient as possible.
Similar to the way a golf ball is designed, there's actually a texture on the golf ball, the dimples, and what the dimples do is they actually help the ball go farther and faster. The dimples create a sort of artificial turbulent boundary layer, increasing the surface friction of the ball itself. But the trade-off is that flow as it wraps around the ball sticks to the ball a little bit better, so that by the time it peels off the back of the ball, there's a much lower pressure drag coming off the back. We found that we could essentially apply the same principle to different parts of a cyclist's body.
If Lance's sleeve were smooth, it would form a low pressure zone directly behind his arm, creating drag. Applying a dimpled texture to the surface, just like on a golf ball, shrinks the trailing low pressure zone. This reduces aerodynamic drag and allows him to go faster.
We found that certain objects of certain sizes, they need to be in a textured finish. Cylinders that are about the size of biceps, about the size of a lower quadricep. So we definitely don't want to put just simply a smooth surface over the entire body, and we don't want to put a rough surface over the entire body. We really want to mix it up a little bit and make sure we get every surface of the body tuned with just the appropriate texture.
The air is going to flow over Lance's back here, and then at a certain point it's going to separate. So we actually reduced this back seam to lower so that the air is going to flow across and then lift off before it hits that seam.
Averaging about 150 grams better than standard issue bib short and jersey, which in a 190 kilometer stage, that's looking like somewhere between 3 to 4 minutes worth of time.
That was it, it was science. Some of the guys, an incredible athlete, but the science took the extra 5 or 6 minutes. And it does in almost all world-class sports. The science will give you 0.5%, 1%, 2%, which at the top levels of any sport is almost invariably the difference between winning and losing. Let's leave that behind. One of the nice things about it is it's one of the most simple devices in every cycle, a very simple device that's basically a person using their own power. Combined, when you start combining it with mathematics and science, you get some incredible efficiencies. But let's still go back to some other creatures. Humans are not the only ones that do things that in one way or another involve mathematics. Honeycombs are interesting things because they've got this wonderful repeating hexagonal shape. And the question is, how did that arise? How come that these little creatures are doing something that is quite clearly Euclidean geometry? They were doing it before Euclid was around. Why did they do it that way? Well, there's a sort of an obvious, we imagine it's to do with efficiency, right? I mean, natural selection favors us the more, the greater efficiency, so over many generations, the bees that can store more honey with the least amount of effort using the least amount of wax are more likely to survive and pass on their genes to their offspring. So it's probably because you maximize the amount of the honey you can store with the minimum amount of material to store in it. That's a reasonable natural selection explanation. And it leads immediately to an optimization question in mathematics. Okay? And in fact, Pappus, way, way back in the 4th century of the current era, said essentially that that was what it is. He wrote an essay, which in English is The Sagacity of Bees, The Wisdom of Bees, and the conjecture which is made there is that the repeating hexagonal pattern in a cross-section of a honeycomb is the architecture that uses the least amount of wax to build the walls. So this conjecture has been around a long time, many thousands of years. And mathematicians are a smart bunch. We like to think we're pretty smart. So how long did it take us to prove whether Pappus was right or not? Well, it took us a couple of thousand years. It wasn't until 1999, 10 years ago this year, that Thomas Hales, then at the University of, was he then? I think he was then at the University of Michigan, he's now at the University of Pittsburgh, solved this problem. It was an interesting solution that involved some classical mathematical arguments and some computational work. I'm not going to go into the details. It was quite not a terribly difficult proof, but certainly tricky proof. Let's just see what the bees were doing. Because in a sense, the bees solved this long before Thomas Hill came along. Here's how these things are made. This is actually kind of interesting. I remember the first time I saw this, I was rather surprised that this is what was going on. I imagined that they sort of put it out and that sort of pressure, air pressure, or sort of, you know, surface tension of things created the shape. But I imagine it was some natural phenomenon, like soap bubbles are formed, something like that. It's not that at all. They build them, like construction workers putting up a building out of prefabricated pieces. The extra slivers of warm wax, each about the size of a pinhead. Other workers are going to take those slivers and actually build the walls. They're going to put them together to form these vertical six-sided cylindrical chambers. With incredible precision, you can imagine that if this is going to be a repeating pattern, if you start to get a bit out, eventually that these things could build up. So the precision is quite important, and in fact it's less than 0.1 millimetre thick to within 0.002 millimetre. So these are pretty smart engineers. Each of the six walls is exactly the same width. The walls meet at an angle of precisely 120 degrees to give you a nice hexagon shape. The cross section is a regular hexagon. It's one of the perfect figures of Greek geometry. So these creatures are naturally evolved Euclidean geometers. The problem then of verifying Pappus' conjecture is that we as humans need to prove a theorem that demonstrates why the bees are doing it that way. Now that problem is couched in terms of three-dimensional things called honeycombs. But it's really just coming down to the cross-section. These are cylinders, so it's all about the cross-section. Okay, the individual cells are all cylindrical cells. It's actually a problem in two-dimensional geometry, which is how the first diagram showed it. Okay, we all just sort of realise that it's the third dimension is irrelevant. It's really the cross-section that counts because they're cylindrical. So the task is, using mathematics, not the bees, the bees are fine, leave the bees alone for now, always a good idea to leave bees alone, of course.
Okay.
Find the two-dimensional shape that can be repeated endlessly to cover a large flat area for which the total length of the perimeter is least. If the amount of wax is least, you want the length of the perimeter to be least. That's the problem, the mathematical, two-dimensional mathematical problem that Pappus's conjecture reduces to. Well, Pappus's conjecture tells you that the two-dimensional shape is in fact a regular hexagon. So the idea is to prove that if you have that the way to satisfy that requirement is to have the basic shape repeated being a regular hexagon. Okay, so another way of saying it, but that pattern we looked at the beginning in the diagram is the one that encloses the maximum area with the minimum total perimeter. It's a minimum total perimeter of just. If we're going to fix the area, in a sense the area can be regarded as infinite. Okay, well what do we know? And now it's just a case of doing some geometry, at least in the early stages. Only three kinds of regular polygons can be fitted together side by side to cover a plane. There's equilateral triangles, there's squares, and there's regular hexagons. That's a fact that goes back a long, long time. Of those, squares certainly give you a smaller perimeter than triangles, and hexagons do better. So of those, of the regular polygons, hexagons win. So if the only choices were between the three regular polygons, the hexagon would be the answer. But there's no reason why the bees or the mathematical question have to focus just on regular polygons. Okay. Among the hexagons, in general, if you're just looking at hexagons, then the regular ones, the ones with the 120 degree angles, they do give a smaller perimeter to the non-regular ones. So we're narrowing down things now. Okay. If we're just looking at these, it's the regular ones. If we're just looking at hexagons, it's the regular ones. But same question again, it doesn't have to just be hexagons. What happens if you allow polygons of all kinds of edges that are not straight lines? Well, then things get complicated. There's no reason why the edges, mathematically, there's no reason why the edges shouldn't be curved. Now, intuitively, it doesn't sound as though that would make a difference. If you curve an edge, you get more wax in one cylinder, but you've got less wax in the next, and it looks as though it's going to balance out. Now, that's actually a pretty good intuition, but that's not a proof. Okay? Proving it is what turned out to be difficult. People had the intuitions, but they didn't come up with the proof. Back in 1943, a Hungarian mathematician called Toth did manage to prove that the regular hexagon pattern gives the smallest total perimeter for all patterns made up of any combination of straight edge polygons. So if you do restrict it to straight edges, which is what the bees do, then you do get regular hexagons. So as far as bees, knowing what we now know about how the bees build it, this answers the question, because they build it with straight edges. But there is then the question about natural selection. If there was another shape with curved edges that was more efficient, then maybe another kind of bee would have become dominant, which makes curved edge ones, and that didn't happen. So the natural selection argument tells us that this actually is the answer, but that's not a mathematical answer. And that was the part that then took a rather complicated new proof that involved quite a bit of computation. If the edges can be curved, things do get tricky. Toth certainly thought that it would be more efficient than anything else, but couldn't prove it, and the intuitions, as I've already alluded to, suggest that as well. Putting bulges in seems to be a net effect of zero. In fact, it seems to make the edges longer without improving anything. So all of our intuitions tell us that this can't possibly reduce less wax. Putting bulges in would seem to reduce more wax. But this is an endless pattern, so it needs to be proved. That's what Thomas Hales did. That's the part he did. He showed that when you allow these things to bend, you don't get any improvements. The actual proof was about 19 pages long for a single answer. So the answer was 19 pages of fairly advanced mathematical arguments. And there's a picture of Thomas Hales, so we can see the picture of the guy that did it. He's smiling because I guess he was pleased that he got the answer. Okay. So, 2,000 years after someone looked at the bees, we got the answer. It took us a while. Sometimes mathematicians are a little bit slow on the uptake, but we tend to get there in the end. We do now know the answer, that the bees are in fact being mathematically as efficient as could be. Next one. Right? This is just a potpourri of things that I've always been curious about, other people that I don't think are maybe curious about, where if you want to understand the answer, mathematics needs to come into the picture. Something else that I always thought was interesting, and lots of other people clearly do, is how do birds and fish migrate? How do they find where to go? I mean, perhaps the most dramatic case is the monarch butterfly. It spreads out all over North America, from Canada day to day, by the way, so they're all up in Canada in the summer, and all over the United States, and then come the fall, they all head west to the Pacific coast, and then they all take a left, and they come down the Pacific coast, they come right through Santa Cruz, to a wonderful little park that I sometimes go to, and then they keep on down to a small area of pine forest just outside Mexico City. And they find their way over that territory, even though it's one of their ancestors that made the journey upwards. These creatures were born there, and they fly down. Somehow, in their genes is an instinct that allows them to follow that path and end up in this very small target area down in Mexico.
So it takes how many generations?
That I don't remember. It's a number of generations, and I remember looking it up and finding the answer, and I forgot.
It's like five or six.
I think it's five or six. It's a number of generations, yeah. I forget exactly how long they live. But it seems almost Lamarckian in how they do it. I mean, it's a fascinating issue. But salmon do the same kinds of things. Some of the geese will fly from the northern, from the Arctic. The Arctic tern will go from one Arctic circle to the other one. Well, the miles of featureless ocean and deserts and things, how do they find their way around? Well, airline pilots do it, but these days they have GPS. But in the past they didn't. They had charts and compasses and things. And ancient mariners found their way around the Mediterranean and then across the Atlantic. And they had compasses and they took sightings of the sun and so forth. And they used a lot of trigonometry. We know that with some equipment, in particular something that tells us where north is, a compass or something, or a sighting of the sun, we can then, using trigonometry, find our way around. And that's typically how you do it. So we know that if we use mathematics and some equipment, we can do it. How do they do it? The equipment may well be part of them. But they have to do the mathematics. How do they know which way to go? Well, quite a lot is known about this. It's known because you can take different creatures, I mean fish for example, you can put them in a big tank in a planetarium. And you can keep moving the sky around artificially. You can put magnets around the outside so you can manipulate the Earth's magnetic field, or you can override the Earth's magnetic field. And you can subject fish in tanks to different kinds of features in the sky, sun, day, light, you can just decide at the length of the day. You can create environments where you can test what the fish respond to and what they don't. You can do the same thing with various other creatures, with bees, butterflies and things. You can put these creatures in artificial environments where you can manipulate things they could be using to see which ones make a difference. And quite a lot has been learned. Okay. Certainly they can use visual clues, and they do. When there are mountains, ridges, coastlines, I mean, remember the monarch butterfly, it heads west till it hits the coast, and then it follows the Pacific coast. Just like Southwest Airlines and Alaska Airlines. You follow down, right? It's just a natural way to do it. But there are some bits there. Eventually you have to leave the coast and go inland. So, but they do use these things. If you can manipulate images of things, you can check that they're following those things. But lots of times, if they're going over large bodies of water or they're flying at night, which they very often do, some of these creatures, how does it work? Position of the sun in the sky? Some of these creatures certainly do that. Of course, it only works if it's not too cloudy. And at night you can navigate by the stars, and that's known to happen. It's also known that some of the birds have to land to recalibrate their starving. They learn how to read the stars when they're in the nest. One of the experiments they did was they took little birds in the nest and covered over their eyes while they were in the nest. Then they took the covers off and these creatures couldn't migrate. They hadn't learned to read the stars. Seems like something. I'm not that kind of a guy, I don't like that, it sort of sounds cruel, but anyway, it did give us some answers. They do navigate by the stars, and they have to land to recalibrate the thing, because of the way it changes. And some of these creatures, they'll land on islands, and some will even land on ships. and spend the night recalculating. And if they can't find anywhere so they can recalibrate, if they don't have an opportunity to recalibrate their mental map, then they get lost. So there's quite a lot been discovered over the years about the way they do it. As I mentioned, they learn it while they're fledging from the nest by observing it. It's an instinct they follow. They can certainly follow the Earth's magnetic field. In fact, there was an article just a couple of weeks ago in one of the science magazines, might have actually been Science, saying that they've found some evidence that it actually uses quantum phenomena in the eyeball, that they can see the Earth's magnetic field. Literally, they can see the Earth's magnetic field through some quantum phenomena. It's kind of interesting. That's somewhat speculative, but it's a new theory that's been proposed. Even if you can't see the sun, if it's a hazy day, the sun will be polarized, and some creatures can certainly see the polarization. So there's lots of clues they can get to tell where north is. And a combination of these things will give you an accurate way of telling where north is. So these creatures have a built-in compass, or a whole selection of built-in compasses. Okay, that tells you where north is. How do you know whether you're going northwest, whatever that? It's got to be fairly precise. That's the bit where we use trigonometry. Now, I don't know any other way to describe what they're doing except in terms of trigonometry. I'm not saying they sit down with a pencil and paper and Pythagoras theorem or something like that, but their natural instinct is to do something that, in human terms, is trigonometry. I don't find that a big, difficult thing. I mean, I've got a little device in my pocket that can do trigonometry. It's just a piece of electronics. It doesn't know what Pythagoras' theorem is, but by God, it can calculate the answer every time I hit the return. So we're used to the fact that devices can be built so that when they do their thing, which in the case of electronic devices, just following the laws of electrical current, makes sense to us in terms of trigonometry. Well, natural selection is also an engineer, and so when these creatures follow their instincts, when they run the circuits the only way they possibly can, a good way for us to understand it is in terms of thinking about trigonometry. Okay. Well, we can sort of get a better sense of that by looking at a creature that does some remarkable things that we really can't understand except in terms of trigonometry. And this is the guy. It's a very heavily studied little ant called Cataglyphis fortis, the Tunisian desert ant. This little critter lives in the sandy deserts in Tunisia. Okay. They live underground, in underground nests in colonies. And there's a sort of extensive colony under the sand, and then there's a little tunnel comes up to the top. And so there's a little hole in the top, you know, the sort of size of your thumbnail, where these things come out. And ant colonies, of course, have different, you know, they have different jobs. And some of the ants, their job is to forage for food. So a forager desert ant will come out of the nest, there's the nest, and it'll head off across the desert looking for food. And it won't find any, so it'll change direction, it'll wander a bit further, and it'll change direction again. This is schematic, it's not a straight line necessarily. Then it'll go off in a different direction, and then it'll go off in a different direction, and then, oh, bingo! It finds some food, you know, the dead insect or whatever it finds. It now has to find its way back to the nest. And by now, it can have travelled maybe 300 metres, which is a long way if you're a little ant, and it can be over 100 metres away from its nest and out of sight of the nest. How is it going to find its way home? Well, it could lay down a scent track and follow the scent track back. That's the Hansel and Gretel solution. Perfectly good solution. Creatures do that. Cataglyphis fortis doesn't do that. Cataglyphis fortis turns round to where the nest is and goes down the nest. It knows not only the orientation of the nest with an incredible accuracy, because that's a tiny little hole in the sand, it knows the distance. It knows the distance exactly. One of the things that these experimenters have done, this has been studied many, many times, they've followed these things, they've waited till they've found the food, then they've moved them and plonked them down somewhere else. The creature will go in the direction it should have gone, for exactly the distance it should go, and then stop looking around bewildered. Well, I don't know if you can tell how an ant is bewildered. So it wanders around in a sort of bewildered looking back. I mean, I know we have some theatre people in the room, and I'm sure it's possible through body motions to indicate confusion, and these creatures do it. So it knows distance, and it knows the orientation very precisely. In fact, I said it's been studied many times. What they do is they stick little tracking devices, little radio tracking devices on them, dress them up for the ball, as it were, and then they follow them with tracking devices to see how they do. So it's been an enormous amount of experimental work on these things. Here's an actual result from a field test. There's the nest. The black line is the path outwards. Then it goes out for a ways, and then it does this really random-looking thing going all sorts of directions, finds the food F, by which time this one had travelled a linear distance of 354 metres. It will then be 113 metres away from the... So there's a 3-to-1 factor of increase on the path on the straight line. But then the dotted line is the path back. In what is it, you know, on a sandy desert, that's to all intents and purposes a straight lane. There's a 10 metre grid to give you some idea of the size. This is a small little ant. That little creature finds its way back with remarkable accuracy. I'm not even sure I could find DuPont circles in that. From here! Let alone from anywhere else. And of course, having found the pants circle, the question is how do you get out of the thing again? Okay. Easy on foot, probably impossible on a bicycle. That's no reason. How on earth is it doing that? Well, this is the technique that we would call dead reckoning. We do know how to solve this problem. You have to keep track exactly with great precision of how far you travel in each direction. You have to keep track of the angle by which you change your direction and how far you go in a new direction. And you keep having to update the information to calculate each time how far it's back. It's sometimes known as a line integral, or well, there's various ways of describing it, but you have to essentially perform lots of trigonometric things. And this is how the ancient mariners did it. It's how Tom Hanks got back from the moon on Apollo 13. Right? If you saw the movie, there was all these calculations where they were laying figures and everything. That was because they were, you know, they didn't want to keep using the batteries because the sister ship had been damaged by that explosion, so when they were trying to come back from the aborted Apollo mission, they were constantly checking their distance, their angles, and calculating their trajectory back. So this has been used for generations until we had GPS, apparently, transatlantic pilots. There was always somebody else, a navigator with a chart, who was constantly doing this, so you could always calculate the way back to the airport. So it's known as dead reckoning, for reasons that nobody knows. It's a strange phrase. Some people thought it's short for deductive reckoning, but the origins of this phrase are not known. But what it amounts to is a lot of trigonometry. It's not difficult mathematics, but you've got to do it accurately. Humans tend to want to use machines to get that degree of accuracy these days. The ant somehow is able to just do it by following its instincts. So the only way I can think of to understand what an ant does is to think that it's a naturally evolved trigonometry machine for solving one particular trigonometric problem, namely the path integral or the deductive reckoning for finding its way back. Okay, let's move ahead. Here's another one that I found curious. When skateboards came along, and friends of mine, I had two daughters and they didn't get into skateboarding, but a friend of mine had a son who got into skateboarding big time. And my friend was a physicist working at Bell Labs. And so he and I sort of watched this son when he was about 12 or 13 going along and jumping on the skateboard. And he and I looked at each other and we said, where's the vertical upward force coming from? Well, I know I can jump upwards. And I know, well, you know, when I bend my legs, the sort of energy stored in the muscles, and I jump upwards and I get momentum and it carries me up a little bit. So it's probably something to do with the skateboard having a spring in it. But it wasn't quite as simple as that, it turned out. It's not that you, I mean, the spring is involved, but it's not just pushing down and letting the spring bounce up. It's much more complicated than that. Okay, so the question is, where does the upward force come from? Because it's on the ground. Something has pushed this thing upwards. The only thing the skateboarder can do is push downwards. So there must be something that's creating the upward force that seems to be sort of bigger than the downward push. It's almost as if you're defying the laws of conservation of energy, but you're clearly not. Well, I pass this on with good authority but no experience. Here's how to do it. Grown-ups, don't try this at home. If you're under the age of 20, you probably know how to do it. If you don't, I'm sure you can try. These are the instructions for how to do it. It was actually, it's called the Ollie. It was invented in 1970s by a guy called Ali Gelfand. Ollie was the nickname. And it's all to do with flipping the thing around the back wheels and then getting enough angular momentum and letting the thing take off. It's a rather interesting piece of stuff. And the mathematics is, this is intuitive mathematics. I'm not sure if anyone's actually calculated all of the details and solved the various equations. Off the web, you can find these instructions on the web, and you can find videos, little YouTube videos. The guy comes along and he goes on the back and puts his weight on the back foot rapidly. It forces the back down. The front flips up and starts to bounce upwards, if you like, in a reaction. It takes the ground, and this is the interesting bit, because you have to understand this, you have to go to a relative frame of reference. Once it's taken off, relative to the position, remember the guy isn't fixed to the board. There's nothing holding the guy to the board. The fact that it's the guy's riding it is an illusion. They're just moving together at the same speed. But in so doing, he drags the outside of his foot up. So relative to himself, he actually drags the board up using friction along the top of the board. That drags it up. Then he starts to shift the weight and it comes back round. Still now the illusion that he's standing on it, but they're both moving at the same speed. And then comes down. How effective can it last? How can you think? Look at that. That's just sort of waist height. I mean, that is kind of remarkable. If it hasn't been done, there's probably a PhD thesis in working out the mathematics behind that one. I find that kind of remarkable, that you can get that degree of lift by just that one action. But we're surrounded by kids that do all this the time, so I do this all the time. I mean, they do that part. I don't know if they do the mathematics. Except implicitly. Right? Okay. And I'm going to finish by going back to cycling, in part because of the Tour de France and in part because I'm just a bicycle nut. And this is a picture of me a few years ago finishing a 100-mile event in the Napa Valley. And I'm turning right. And I'm leaning to the right. Now the question is, why did I do that? Cyclist makes a right turn. The cyclist is leaning to the right. For obvious reasons, so you need to counter, there's a centrifugal force, you need to counter it, so you're putting your weight over to one side. We do the same thing if we're running or walking fast. Well, if you're running and you want to turn to the right, you find yourself leaning to that side. And in fact, the easy mathematics is calculating how much lean you need to turn the bike around. This is high school mathematics. Okay, you can do it. It's just trigonometry. You've got various forces. This is easy. Okay, so we can calculate the degree of lean involved in turning a bicycle, which makes us think that we understand what's going on. Okay. Am I leaning because I'm turning? Or am I turning because I'm leaning? I've been doing this for years, I've no idea. I suspect Lance Armstrong doesn't know either. More specifically, how did I start that turn? What did I do with my handlebars in order to turn right? Did I turn them to the right? Or did I turn to the left? How many people think I turned them to the right in order to turn right? How many people think I turned them to the left? The rest of you have no idea. It's kind of perplexing, actually. It's a simple device. It's a human being, and it's just two wheels and a bit of metal and like a very expensive composite fiber, actually. But it's a simple piece of device, and yet it's not at all clear how we do it. I mean, pretty well everyone in the room, I'm sure, can ride a bicycle, and we've learned how to ride a bicycle. And there was a learning about a bicycle. It's a funny process because there's a long period when you can't, and then suddenly you can. What's happening there at that moment? Well, it turns out you've learned something in your body that your mind is probably not aware of. One of the things you've learned is if you want to turn right, you turn the wheels to the left. And if you want to turn left, you turn the handlebars to the right. You're almost certainly not aware of this. But that's what you're doing. Okay, and then let's see why. What happens? I was coming along here, I turned my wheels, handlebars slightly to the left. That caused the bike to lean to the right. I'm actually falling down in a controlled way. What a cyclist does going around the corner is you're literally falling around the corner. Because my centre of gravity is suddenly gone to the right of the plane, down there, that's forcing me that way. I'm falling to the right, at which point I instinctively turn the handlebars to the right to stop from falling and control the fall. So the handlebars do two things. They start the turn by turning the opposite way, and then they turn into the turn to stop you falling and turning what would be a fall into a turn. That's actually what you're doing. What mathematics looks like. Turns out the mathematics of cycling is extremely complicated. Okay. You probably don't believe me. You might not believe me. Okay. Well, you're mathematicians, it's a mathematical audience. I will convince you with the mathematics. Turns out that I might not convince you because it gets very complicated. This is a very complicated system. Because the bicycle has actually got some interesting features of its design. First of all, you've got a road bike, you've got a wheel of just over 2 millimeters thick, 2 centimeters thick. Slightly bigger than your thumb. That's the width of the tyre. It's pumped up to about 120 pounds per square inch, which is 4 times the pressure in an automobile tyre. So you've got this very high pressure, very thin wheel. The point of contact is as close to a single point as you're going to get. That's very, very minimal contact. It turns out that the steering axis is slightly to the rear of the wheel axis. If they were in line, it would be very unstable. If you make the offset big, it's hard to steer it. So there's actually a lot of precision involved in how much you make that for different types of performance bicycles, how much you offset that. But that adds a complication, and then there are various other parameters. There are not that many parameters, but there are enough to make it a rather complicated piece of mathematics. One way to find the answer is the way that most of our students they go to Wikipedia. Which in my experience, for mathematical questions, is pretty accurate. So for all those of you who are students, Wikipedia is probably okay. However, you know, the professor will probably want to ask qualitative penetrating questions about your answer. Here's how it found on Wikipedia. This is kind of nice because it's classic mathematics, right? A rigid frame, a rigid fork, two knife-edged rigid wheels. So the absolute precision, all connected with frictionless bearings and rolling without friction or slip on a smooth horizontal surface and operating at or near the upright and straight ahead unstable equilibrium. This is the idealized bicycle. What? Let alone the complicated real one. An idealized bicycle where everything is reduced to straight lines, what do the equations of turning a bicycle look like? Well, they look a bit like that. Can be represented by a single fourth order linearized ordinary differential equation or two coupled second order differential equations. The lean equation is a little more complicated than that one I looked at a minute ago, and the steering equation. But this looks remarkably like Newtonian mechanics, right? I mean, you've even got the dot notation and so forth. So this is fairly classical calculus stuff, but it's complicated. Where you've got lean of the rear assembly, steer angle of the front assembly, relative to the rear assembly, moments applied to the, you've got various parameters, and then on it goes. It's undergraduate level mathematics, but it's not easy mathematics, so you may be sort of thinking, yeah, that's not really the answer I'm looking for. I can ride a bike, and I can't necessarily do that, so what's really going on? Well, there are actually, as with the airplanes, there's an easy way to understand it. An easy way to understand it is just in terms of plain old momentum. You're cycling along, there's your momentum in that direction. When you turn the wheel to the side, the momentum is now to the left of what this thing's trying to do. It's trying to follow the front wheel, no doubt about that. But the momentum, which is the big force here, is going in that direction. So your momentum is to the left. So that's just going to push you that way. You're going to want to follow your momentum. And so you're going to end up to turn left. This is the key step that gets you into the turn. At this point, the cyclist is actually turning the wheel to the left. Incidentally, you can do this without turning the wheel at all, just by balance. It's all to do with putting the weight together. I am told. I'm not that good a bicyclist. But I'm told you can do the whole thing without pumping the wings with all. That's what's known as counter-steering. It's actually simply to start the thing moving. And in case you still don't believe me, let's look at a video of this in action. This is a video, the first one you see will be a motorbike, which is easier to understand because it can do it much more slowly, relatively speaking, and then we'll see it with the bicycle. It's known as counter-steering. Sometimes it's easier to do it, but if you want to see it done, here we go.
Keep your eye on the front tire and the bike's angle for gravity. See how the tire briefly aims to your left and the bike quickly leans to your right? Once there's enough lean angle and everything's balanced, he steers into the turn. It's that moment, when the tire is steering away from the turn, that is counter-steering. Counter-steering doesn't just work for motorcycles. It also works for bicycles, although it happens very quickly due to a bicycle's low weight. In this shot, the rider is coming toward the camera at around 10 miles per hour. As with a motorcycle, it's a simple twitch of the wheel to lean the bike, then steer into the turn. Counter-steering both leans a bike over and picks it back up, as this shot demonstrates.
So if you ride a bike, that's what you've been doing all these years, then you're probably not aware of it. One thing you can try, if you're confident enough in your balance, is ride along the cycle, take your hands off the handlebars, then just pull the left of the handlebars slightly towards yourself. If you pull the left handlebar towards yourself, your bike will go to the right. If you do it to the right, it will go to the left. If you do it slightly too much, you'll fall down. Okay. This is a math lecture. It's in a mathematics establishment, so there has to be some homework. Here's the homework. Here's a cyclist cycling along on some sand. Comes along in this direction and starts to initiate a turn. The front wheel has gone round a larger arc. The rear wheel has followed. Any person who's opened a calculus book will think of, an area enclosed by two curves. What's the obvious thing to ask if you're a mathematician? What's the area between the two curves? Well, let's just see how well you understand calculus. Find a formula for the area between the two wheels. Now, you may say, I don't know the equations of the two curves. And indeed, you don't. You may say, without the equation of the two curves, I can't work out the answer. Not true. You actually don't need to know the formula for the curves in order to calculate the area between those two curves. Doesn't mean to say that all of those formulas you've learned for working out areas between curves are irrelevant, but in this situation, they're certainly not important. Now, of course, the answer has to be given in terms of some parameters, but the parameters are the natural ones of the problem. You've got the point where the turn starts, you've got the point where the turn finishes. There's an angle of the turn. And there's a distance between the front and the beginning. And there's probably some other parameters. In terms of natural parameters like angles and distances, I'm not saying you need all of these. I'm not saying all of the ones you need are here. But in terms of natural parameters that you could measure, the curve not being one of them, because we don't know what the shape of the curve is, what's the area between them? And the clue is, how well do you understand calculus? The second clue is, there is a guy who could have answered this question 2,000 years ago. That actually is a very, very big clue. But it's the only clue you're going to get. This has an actual answer, it is a formula, and it's a simple formula. And it gives you the answer. And it's one of those questions that you will go along for a period thinking, can't be done, can't be done, can't be done. Oh, good Lord, yes. Do it on your own. Don't ask for help. Because it's really neat when you see the light. Someone asked me this. I only came across this a year ago. And I was driving home from giving a talk. And I almost crashed the car. And I said, oh, yes. And it's that one of those wonderful feelings. But it isn't really that hard. But it's sufficiently hard that when you see it, it's a great little feeling. So I'll leave you to think about that one. Thank you.